This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Building a new cabinet post-Trump, President-elect Biden picks a longtime ally for Secretary of State Tony Blinken.
Tony is going to have to work with our partners and allies around the globe to convince them that Donald Trump's administration was more of an aberration.
Also today, a secret meeting in Saudi Arabia between the Crown Prince and Israel's Prime Minister. Some think they're sending a message to Iran before the White House changes guard.
Iran, beware. We still have 2 months to coordinate and do things.
And Ethiopia is in turmoil. Fighting between the government and breakaway forces could be coming to a head.
Within the next 72 hours, we might see the final showdown.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. It is good to have you with us on this Monday. When it comes to America's future relationship with the rest of the world, we're starting to get a sense of the approach President-elect Joe Biden might take. Biden is expected to announce some key cabinet picks tomorrow. The word right now is that Biden has chosen Antony Blinken for the coveted post of Secretary of State. Blinken has served in many roles over the years, most recently as Deputy Secretary of State under President Barack Obama. Former CIA Director John Brennan has worked closely with Blinken. He says Blinken is well-positioned to start repairing America's ties to traditional allies.
I think Tony has the deft touch needed. He is, in many respects, a quintessential diplomat. Although he was never, you know, working his way up through the Department of State as a Foreign Service officer, he has an approach, an attitude, and I think a vision also that is going to allow the United States to repair some of the damage that has been done. I think he's not going to cut corners. He really is going to spend time talking to United States friends abroad. But also, I think he's going to deal very forthrightly with some of our adversaries that are out there. There's going to be a tough policy, I think, on China on a number of fronts, as well as with Russia. So I think Tony brings together the knowledge, the experience, as well as the personal relationship with Joe Biden that is so, so important for a Secretary of State to have.
Also today, Director Brennan, according to several outlets, Avril Haines is tipped to be Director of National Intelligence. What can you tell us about her?
She has a lot of experience. She worked also on the Hill. She has a law degree. Her undergraduate degree is in physics. She's a pilot, a martial arts black belt, but she is steeped in the law. She was the National Security Council's legal counsel for several years when I first worked with her in the Obama administration. Then I selected her as my deputy at CIA because of her breadth of experience and her pragmatic approach to national security challenges. And then when she became the principal Deputy National Security Advisor at the White House, I think she really demonstrated her ability to work very closely with others in that interagency environment.
Director Brennan, you know perhaps better than anyone that the State Department and U.S. intelligence agencies need to have a smooth working relationship. Here actually is Tony Blinken speaking on Intelligence Matters. That's a podcast of former acting CIA Director Michael Morell.
A President Biden will not politicize intelligence, will insist that truth always be spoken to power, will demand that people bring their best analysis and best judgment and not in any way shape it to what they perceive to be the political desires or political interests of the incumbent.
Tony Blinken makes it sound pretty easy. What kind of lift do you think it'll be, Director Brennan, for Avril Haines at National Intelligence to depoliticize U.S. intelligence?
I don't think it's going to be much of a lift at all, because the professionals in the intelligence community really want that objectivity and integrity of the intelligence community to be restored. It has been the administration, the White House, and the senior members, unfortunately, of the Directorate of National Intelligence that have politicized intelligence. So Joe Biden recognizes the importance of making sure that that intelligence community will be apolitical, nonpartisan, as well as objective in terms of the intelligence it provides to policymakers. And I think Tony Blinken at State Department will work very, very well with Avril Haines and other senior members of the intelligence community for the good of the country.
John Brennan is a former CIA director. He's been speaking with us about his time working with President-elect Joe Biden's likely pick as Secretary of State, Tony Blinken. John Brennan's new memoir is called Undaunted. Director Brennan, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Marco.
In Brazil, protesters across the country have taken to the streets after the brutal killing of a black man. A string of violent incidents against black Brazilians in recent months have energized the Black Lives Matter movement there. From southern Brazil, here's more from reporter Michael Fox.
A seemingly endless crowd of people marches slowly up the street. They're silent, except for the sound of a lone bass drum. Each of them has a fist raised in the air. Some of those in the crowd are black. Many are not. Most wear masks. A woman carries a large piece of cardboard with the words Black Lives Matter, João Freitas. This is the funeral procession for João Alberto Silveira Freitas, a 40-year-old black man who on November 19th was beaten and killed by security guards at a Carrefour supermarket in the Brazilian city of Porto Alegre, the southernmost state capital. The brutal video of his beating went viral, sparking outrage on the eve of Black Consciousness Day in Brazil. The day was founded 50 years ago by a group in Porto Alegre to commemorate Black pride and resistance. The date marks the death in 1695 of Brazil's most historic Black hero, Zumbi dos Palmares. He was the leader of the country's largest settlement of escaped slaves in the 17th century. This year, the day took on an even more urgent meaning when protests erupted at Carrefour supermarkets around the country. People marched into a store in Belo Horizonte, chanting murder and racist. At a store in Brazil's capital, Brasilia, protesters rallied in front of the meat aisle. We are protesting racism and demanding an end to the genocide against the black community, said activist Helen Frida, who attended the protest. Thousands turned out for one of the largest marches in Porto Alegre since the beginning of the pandemic. During his speech to the G20 summit over the weekend, President Jair Bolsonaro denied the existence of racism in Brazil and lashed out at protesters.
Contudo, há quem queira destruí-la e colocar em seu lugar o conflito.
He said, there are those that want to destroy Brazilian unity and put in its place conflict, resentment, hate, and racial division, always masked as the fight for equality or social justice, all in search of power. There is a myth, long held by many in Brazil, that since U.S. Jim Crow-style segregation never existed here, then there's no racism in Brazil. It's called the myth of racial democracy. Reginete Bispo is a longtime member of the Black movement in Porto Alegre. She's also a sociologist who leads the Black Women's Institute, ACANI. She says, racism in Brazil is endemic. It's everywhere, it's every day. Racism in Brazil is recognized across the globe because this is one of the countries that most kills blacks. More than 50,000 young black men and women are killed every year in Brazil. The killing of João Freitas was all the more tragic, coming just days after the election of five new young black city council members in Porto Alegre. It was an important win in what is considered one of the most racist cities in the country. Mateus Gomes was one of those just elected to city council. He put some of the blame for the killing of black people on far-right President Bolsonaro.
Bolsonaro, ele tem responsabilidade direta no que está acontecendo.
He says, Bolsonaro is directly responsible for what has happened, through his hate discourse, for his attempt to ignore the racial problems, and for being part of those that today instigate violence in different ways, particularly through the police and private security. The Carrefour supermarket chain has said it would end its contract with the security company responsible for João Freitas' death. It said it would also fire the store manager. But according to reports, this is one of a string of racist incidents and labor violations committed by the supermarket chain. João Freitas was a welder. He left behind five children. Activists across the country have vowed to continue to fight against the racist violence and death that continues to plague Brazil. For The World, I'm Michael Fox in Florianópolis, Brazil.
Who says you can't hold massive sporting events during a pandemic? In Shanghai, 600 players quarantined for 3 weeks to compete in a competition that will last a month. The Korean team, Damwon, took first at the League of Legends World Championships, but China nabbed the prize for most esports fans in the world. The World's Rebecca Canther in Shanghai explains.
When Haile Liu was a kid in Beijing in the 2000s, she played computer games like these.
My mom doesn't want me to play those. She just wants me to focus on my study. That's like Chinese parents.
Later, she went to the U.S. for high school. She started playing League of Legends with her friends back in China. It helped her keep up her Chinese, she says. But her mom still disapproved. Liu secretly stayed up late gaming after her parents went to bed. And she and her friends watched League of Legends tournaments together online.
When I play those games, I feel like very exciting and like you can forget about other things happened in your daily life.
杨永信的心理课堂是为在网瘾戒治中心接受治疗。Back
when she was a kid, it was common to see news reports like this one about the dangers of computer games.
网络这种高科技含量的事物给人类的生活带来了极大的变化。
In this program, teenagers wearing military fatigues are shown going through group therapy to cure them of addiction. A decade later, so much has changed. Today, China is a country of gamers. Roughly half the population plays some sort of online game. That's more than 600 million people. And professional esports leagues are booming. At the League of Legends World Championships held in Shanghai last month, more than 3 million people entered to win a ticket to attend the finals. Only 6,000 were allowed in because of social distancing rules. Outside the stadium, almost everyone in line looked to be under 30. This young woman, who's an engineer, won a ticket and traveled over 500 miles to be in the live audience. I've been playing League of Legends for 8 years now, she says. I wanted to come today to feel the energy of watching with a crowd. Korean team Damwon won the championship trophy, which came with its own Louis Vuitton carrying case. It's one of the many major brands that's moving into esports territory. Here in the heart of Shanghai, a Nike store has put esports gear at the center of its floor display. There are League of Legends team jerseys, shoes, and clothing. There's even a gaming area where you can play while you shop. While a lot of the esports gear is targeted to younger gamers, it also appeals to people in their 30s and 40s. So along with Nike, MasterCard, Mercedes-Benz, MAC Cosmetics, they're all signing esports sponsorship deals too. AJ Jilka is a sports marketer who worked on the Nike deal with China's League of Legends Pro League.
One of the biggest eye-openers for me is that it's not just about kids. It's also about people who have purchasing power, who still look at it as a form of entertainment, but they have the means to spend on that.
And League of Legends players are shoppers. Even inside the game, there are opportunities to purchase merchandise. China runs on mobile transactions, which makes this shopping seamless.
I don't have to physically go to the store and buy that. I can just like swipe, tap, and consume. I already have that virtual product to then put on my avatar. And I can do it within the space of half a second.
Cities like Shanghai and Chongqing are jumping on the bandwagon too, promoting themselves as esports bases to attract investors. But Frederick Yang, a video game industry veteran who now runs a chain of arcades, says that China's support of gaming is complicated. He says there's a lot of contradictions in how the government regulates esports. There are time limits for younger players to prevent addiction. No games involving gambling or featuring blood or dead bodies. No playing online with gamers outside of China. At the same time, the government wants to support the growth of esports in China. Last year, it recognized esports as a profession, opening the way for training and job opportunities. Haile Liu, the League of Legends fan, hopes to land one of them. And this time, her mom has given her full support.
Well, my mom right now, she just thinks if I can get a job and I can earn money by myself, she's really happy about that. So,
esports will continue to expand here, offering China more opportunities to cash in on the growing number of gamers, but also more challenges in how to control them. For The World, I'm Rebecca Canther in Shanghai.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. A secret visit in the Middle East is not so secret anymore. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu flew to Saudi Arabia last night, according to news reports. He met with Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman during U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo's visit in the kingdom. There's been no official confirmation of the visit, but it has got people talking. I'm joined by The World's Ariel Osaran in Jerusalem. Remind us why, first of all, Ariel, the Israeli Prime Minister visiting the Saudi Crown Prince in the kingdom is so unusual, and what do we know about this visit so far?
Well, Marco, there's not a lot of information out there, given that no side has put out an official statement acknowledging the visit. But according to reports in Israeli media, Netanyahu flew in a private jet to the Red Sea city of Neom, where he met with the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. This is a pretty big deal, Marco. It's the first known meeting between high-level Israeli and Saudi leaders. And what's interesting to note here is that even after the reports, the Saudis are still denying it, saying no such meeting occurred.
Some news reports, though, including the Wall Street Journal, are saying that this was confirmed. So why are the Saudis still denying this happened?
I asked Yoel Guzansky about this. He's at the Institute for National Security Studies in Tel Aviv and a former Israeli National Security Council official. Guzansky says that Netanyahu probably leaked the news about this meeting for internal political reasons, because Israel's unity government is in trouble. You know, there's talks here about upcoming elections. But for the Saudis, Guzansky says, this could be very embarrassing.
The Saudis are not ready to go public. If they were ready, you would see a photo op of Pompeo, bin Salman, and Netanyahu. It's that simple.
So no photo op, but news of this meeting is out, Ariel. I mean, people are talking about it. This notion of, you know, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and Israel having diplomatic relations. We're not there yet, but that's what's being kind of proffered. What do you think this meeting signals to Israel's neighbors?
Yeah, so I asked Guzansky about this too, and here's what he had to say.
It might be a signal to Iran. Iran, beware. We still have 2 months to coordinate and do things.
Guzansky also mentioned that the U.S. Air Force flew B-52 bombers over Israeli airspace just 2 days ago. That was certainly a message to the Iranians. And of course, we know that President Trump has only 2 months left in office. Here's Yoel Guzansky again.
The other audience might be Biden and the upcoming administration, basically saying, look, we have a regional framework here. Don't ruin it. Continue on what we built.
So, Ariel, this visit comes amid a flurry of diplomatic breakthroughs between Israel and its Arab neighbors. Should we be expecting to see a normalization agreement between Israel and Saudi Arabia anytime soon?
Not really, Marco. I mean, for a while now, Secretary of State Pompeo has been trying to persuade the Gulf powerhouse to follow the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Sudan in establishing formal relations with Israel, a rapprochement built largely on shared concerns about Iran. But the Saudis have so far declined to normalize ties with Israel, saying Palestinian statehood goals should be addressed first. You know, most analysts are saying that normalization is not likely to happen soon, if at all. The details to be worked out between these two countries are complicated, to say the least.
The World's Ariel Osaran in Jerusalem on a secret, not-so-sacred visit Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu paid to the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia. Ariel, thank you very much.
Thanks, Marco.
The world's most powerful people came together over the weekend for the annual G20 summit. Of course, it was on Zoom. Saudi Arabia played host and touted the event as a success. Families of imprisoned Saudis have a different opinion. They say the G20 was used to whitewash the kingdom's abysmal human rights record. Those families held a separate counter summit. Here's the world's Shirin Jafari.
It's as if the speakers were talking about two entirely different countries. First, there was the Saudi Arabia portrayed by the government, and then the kingdom described by relatives of imprisoned activists. In the official G20 summit, there was no shortage of theatrics. Social media accounts connected to the government pushed videos like this one. Yes, Saudi jets fly over the capital, Riyadh, followed by a scene with a man in traditional outfit riding a black horse in the middle of the desert. He's proudly carrying a flag with the logo of the G20 summit. There's a reason the kingdom went all out to promote this year's event, says Christian Colt Erickson. He's a political scientist at Rice University.
It would send a strong signal that Saudi Arabia is back among the top table of global leadership.
Saudi Arabia's image has been hit hard in recent years, he says. The CIA says Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman ordered the killing of Jamal Khashoggi in 2018. Khashoggi was a columnist for the Washington Post. Under the rule of the Crown Prince, Saudi Arabia has also jailed activists, writers, religious leaders, and even members of the royal family. And so, as the official G20 summit painted Saudi Arabia as a country that will lead the world into a better, brighter future, relatives of those imprisoned described a different side to the kingdom. They told their stories on Friday as part of a counter-summit. It was organized by PEN America and several other human rights organizations.
My brother was kidnapped from his office at the Red Crescent in Riyadh in 2018, March.
Arija Sultan said for weeks her family couldn't get any information about her brother Abdul Rahman. All they knew was that he was taken by Saudi security forces.
We tried to find out what was his charge, and they would not tell us anything. They would say that he is still under investigation. Where is he? We don't know where he is. They wouldn't tell us where he was.
The family kept silent, worried that by speaking out, they might jeopardize Abdul Rahman's situation. But then they got word that he'd been tortured and that his life might be in danger.
I decided I have to go public. So I posted on Twitter, "Where is my brother?" And the moment I did that, I started to receive threats.
Relatives of three Saudis currently detained in the country said their loved ones are being punished for simply expressing criticism on social media. Arija Sultan, whose brother is detained, said she has even received death threats. Still, she said, she and others have no option but to speak up.
All of our relatives are in danger. They're facing the threat of what Jamal Khashoggi have seen on a daily basis. And our voices is the only thing that can help us.
The Saudi embassy in Washington did not respond to an interview request for this story. But some members of Congress continue to ask questions. A few of them sent video messages to Friday's counter-summit.
Hello, I'm Congressman Adam Schiff. I want to thank...
We've seen so many peaceful advocates be unjustly detained without...
America has long been a bulwark against authoritarianism and a defender of human rights.
You will always have an ally in Congress in your fight for free expression.
Activists and relatives of imprisoned Saudis were calling for the boycott of this year's G20. But President Trump, Justin Trudeau, Boris Johnson, Angela Merkel, and other G20 leaders attended the virtual summit. Foreign Saudi Minister Adel Al-Jubeir dismissed concerns about his country's human rights record in an interview with the BBC.
Our judiciary is independent, and we do not allow people to lecture us or dictate to us what we should or shouldn't do, just like we don't tell people in the UK or in America or in other places what they should or should not do.
Jubeir complained that Saudi Arabia has been treated unfairly and that people, quote, always look for the negative instead of the positive. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
You're with The World. Protesters in Thailand are doing the unthinkable, calling for the monarchy to be reformed.
It's illegal to criticize the monarchy in this country.
For religious conservatives, that's not just illegal, it's blasphemy. That's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, you're with The World. We come to you from GBH Boston and PRX. Ethiopia has been a bright spot in the developing world over the past two decades. Incomes, literacy, and life expectancy have all gone up dramatically. Ethiopia's economy got a kickstart thanks to some serious investment from China. But new fighting between Ethiopia's central government and the opposition party that governs the northern region of Tigray, this is presenting new and serious challenges. Journalist Mary Kay Magstad has been following the trail of Chinese investment around the globe in a podcast called China's New Silk Road. As we hear now, her reporting led her to Tigray, but she opens her story in Ethiopia's capital.
In the capital, Addis Ababa, Chinese projects abound. My travel companion is Tesfalem Waldyes, an Ethiopian journalist working with me to explore the impact of Chinese investment.
So
just walking distance. The newly built stadium is just on the other way.
So there's this Chinese-built tram.
Yes.
Chinese-built ring roads.
Yes.
Stadium.
And the financial district, many of the headquarters of Ethiopian banks are built by the Chinese.
In a cab later, driving around, it's clear how much Chinese construction in recent years has transformed the Addis Ababa skyline. Tess says many locals are impressed.
They say that our city looks like Dubai now. And people are really surprised by the pace of building of such high buildings. So people are used to take pictures, admire the buildings, and they really loved it. They felt it like Addis Ababa is developing, Ethiopia is developing. Now we are catching the rest of the world.
There are two very different ways of looking at Chinese loans in Africa, and they're not mutually exclusive. One is that these help poor countries leapfrog forward. The other is that China is setting debt traps in at least some places, using the infrastructure itself, or sometimes the commodities the infrastructure produces, like oil, as collateral if the borrower can't repay the loan. Wherever you come down on this, it's fair to say that Chinese lenders are not doing this out of the goodness of their hearts. Like many Western countries that have given similar loans before in Africa, China's state lenders expect to profit, to throw business to Chinese companies, and to gain stature and strategic positions in Africa. China's loans often have higher interest rates and shorter payback periods than those from the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. So, something I've heard more than once while covering Chinese activities around the world is, you'd better know what you want when you come to the table, because the Chinese know what they want. Ethiopia's government wants a better life for its 110 million people. So it's taken at least $13 billion in loans from China out of its total $29 billion external debt. Economist Elamayehu Geda is not a flat-out fan of everything China's doing in Ethiopia, but neither does he think full-speed privatization is the best way forward for a country where almost a quarter of the population still lives in poverty. Another Ethiopian economist, Getachew Alemu, agrees.
Essentially, I see the Ethiopian economy as an economy that still needs huge public investment. Our markets are very hierarchical, very traditional, fragmented. So even if we wish to have a market-driven economy, we don't have the markets yet.
And he says China deserves credit for having come in early to fund some of those efforts at a time when many Western investors found Ethiopia and Africa in general to be too risky.
Economies like the Ethiopian economy are considered to be frontier markets for capital markets in the West because of the high risk involved in the market and the challenges around it. So although the Western capital was considering Africa and Ethiopia as frontier markets, China was actually really courageous enough to kind of get involved in such a market. So it really helped us. We used to have a huge backlog of demand for infrastructure. We didn't have the finance to kind of finance it and push our economy forward. So the Chinese capital came as a savior for us.
I heard this a lot as I went around rural Tigray months before the conflict with the government erupted. These village kids also wanted to show off what they'd been learning in school.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
Tess tells me when rural kids in Ethiopia see a foreigner, they often call out, China, China, because those are the foreigners they've seen here, building roads, putting up poles for electric lines, building the Tekezi Dam a decade ago, which now provides electricity, fish from the reservoir, and convenience for local villagers in Tigray. Another Chinese dam is now being built near Tigray's capital, Mekelle. Driving in from a steep hill above, you can see the contours of a dam that will help provide water to more than 300,000 people in Mekelle, instead of having to drill down hundreds of feet to find it.
From what I understand, we just talked to the Mekelle Water Office, and they said they only have about half as much water as they need right now. How much is this going to help close that gap?
After 3 years, the project will be functional, and the
Mekele people, the problem for the scarcity of the water is solved.
It'll be enough to make up for the water they do not have now.
Yeah.
It's a big deal.
Yeah.
This is Hagos Bayrou. He's an Ethiopian hydroelectric engineer working with the Chinese team that's building this dam.
Yeah, we took experience from the Chinese how to design the dam.
Chinese expertise helps, he says, though Ethiopian engineers like himself already knew a fair bit about building dams. What really helps is the Chinese loan that's covering about 80% of the cost of building this dam. The water from the dam will also help Mekele's new Chinese-built industrial park. Goitom Fabrikadan is the general manager here.
I think this is a good view for...
This is a good view.
He takes us up to the roof of the one-stop office to get a panoramic view of the industrial park. Below, young women workers laugh and chat as they carry big sheets of plywood on their backs. Already, Goitom says, there are 3,500 workers here, and it'll go up to 20,000 at full capacity. There are Indian companies here making T-shirts and leggings, a Romanian-Bangladesh joint venture, and Chinese companies setting up.
So what kind of impact do you think this will have on the local economy?
So a good boost for the economy because, for example, I'm talking about 20,000 people, only the operators.
20,000 workers need food, housing, transportation. That's good for the local economy, too. And there are two new access roads.
One to the city, the second one to the airport, the big one. Yeah, straight to the airport.
It's this kind of transformation of lives that can happen with investments and infrastructure done well that excites Daniel McConan, the deputy commissioner of Tigray's Investment Commission. He says he saw what can happen when he visited the Chinese city of Shenzhen near Hong Kong, a place that was once a collection of fishing villages and 40 years later is a cosmopolitan city of millions of people and a tech and innovation hub.
Shenzhen, 40 years back, it was a fisher society. Now it's becoming an industrial city. I like. Not only Tigray, not only Mekele, Addis, Ethiopia, not only Addis, Nairobi. Every city of Africa, every city of the world to be as Shenzhen.
But the future has a way of throwing curveballs, and Tigray's future cooperation with China and plans for prosperity are on hold for the moment as it clashes with the federal government. That's a curveball for China, too, in its plans to have an economic and strategic presence in the Horn of Africa. And Ethiopia has, of late, been kind of a showcase country for Chinese investments. But over time, African enthusiasm about such investments has been tempered in some places by experience.
So unlike colonialism, where they were colonies and pawns, now countries are being much smarter and saying we will not be caught in this situation.
This is Parag Khanna. He's a global strategy advisor and author of books including The Future is Asian and Connectography, Mapping the Future of Global Civilization. Parag is a U.S. citizen, born in India, now living in Singapore, who's traveled widely on China's New Silk Road and beyond.
I think that what all of this comes down to is agency, right? At the end of the day, what Beijing and Washington are both missing and always miss, and what superpowers and empires in general historically tend to miss, is that those lesser states have agency, and they have a lot more confidence than they did before. And the more the global system becomes a geopolitical marketplace of multiple competing powers, the more agency these smaller countries can actually have because they get to practice this multi-alignment very actively. And therefore, if you want to win what you think is a bipolar struggle, you actually have to be much more active in courting these countries rather than giving them false choices.
China's Belt and Road Initiative is changing the world, just not always in the way China's leaders wanted or expected, and not only with China in the driver's seat. For all its imperfections, the Belt and Road Initiative may actually leave as its legacy a more multipolar world. And that, certainly, could be considered a win-win.
Mary Kay Magsad reporting there for the project on China's New Silk Road from the Global Reporting Center. Her reporting partner on that story we just heard is Tesfalem Waldiez. They both join me now. Tess, let me start with you there in the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. For many outsiders, it looks as if Ethiopia right now is embroiled in a civil war that risks spilling over into other parts of the Horn of Africa. What are you hearing today from the northern region of Tigray, where this conflict is unfolding?
What happened today is that in early morning, another rocket was fired to a northern city called Bahardar. It is the seat of the Amara regional government. There is no official statement that came from the federal government, but the TPLF took responsibility for rocket firing.
That's the Tigray People's Liberation Front.
So yesterday, before this incident happened, the Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed gave the TPLF leadership. He gave 72 hours to surrender peacefully to the government. So within the next 72 hours, we might see the final showdown.
So I want to know more about how this growing conflict is kind of intersecting with China's interests in Ethiopia. So before we go deeper into this conflict, let's talk a bit about how Ethiopia has grown economically in the past 20 years. I was reporting in Ethiopia in 2005, and China was just really starting to dig in there. Since then, China's become the country's largest investor. So what is the big headline in terms of economic growth in Ethiopia over the past 20 years?
Ethiopia is one of the fastest growing country in the world. And China's contribution for that is immense, from building, from dams to highways to telecommunication infrastructures, a national stadium, football stadium. And wherever you go in the country, you'll find Chinese people, paving new roads, asphalted roads. And also, if you come to Addis Ababa, the skyline of Addis Ababa is totally changed now. Mm. It will be the financial district of Addis Ababa. Most of the buildings are now currently under construction by the Chinese construction companies. Mm.
No doubt I would not recognize it if I were to go. Mary Kay, you lived and reported from China for nearly two decades. You visited Tigray for this podcast. So given what you know about how China does business, what do you think Chinese authorities are thinking right now in light of the growing conflict in Tigray?
Well, hard to know what they're thinking, but the way they're playing it in government-controlled media is quite straight down the line. I will say, there are a number of Chinese projects that are already completed in Ethiopia, roads, a railway going from Addis Ababa all the way to the port of Djibouti, where China and the United States have military bases. There are all kinds of reasons why China wants a stable and peaceful Horn of Africa, because China's investments in the region are for strategic reasons as well as for economic reasons. So this isn't good from China's perspective that there is a conflict in a place where China has a lot of investment. But at this point, they're hanging back and letting it play out the way it's going to play out.
So a question for both of you. Let me put it to Mary Kay, you first. The Chinese government says it doesn't meddle in the internal affairs of other countries, but we know it has a history of doing so. How has that played out in Ethiopia?
The way the Chinese government, from my experience, seeing how the Chinese government kind of uses its influence in different countries, it doesn't tend to be in really public statements most of the time. It tends to be behind the scenes, and it tends to be with some leverage that it has. Because, for instance, in Ethiopia, there is something between $13 billion and, even as much as $16 to $19 billion in loans owned to the Chinese government. There certainly is some leverage for the Chinese government to use one way or the other if things are not going the way that the Chinese government feels is in its best interest in places like Ethiopia.
Tess Falem, are you concerned about China exerting influence in the affairs of Ethiopia, specifically around Tigray and the conflict there right now?
I don't think so. Tigray is one region of Ethiopia. Some people are make it like a parallel, like Hong Kong, or you can say Taiwan. Mm. So the Ethiopian federal government narrative is Tigray is like a rebellious group, is the one who is trying to destabilize the country. So I don't think so the Chinese government will spoil their relationship with the federal government because of one single region of the country.
Mary Kay, we've been following you around the globe over the past 2 months, from China to neighboring Kazakhstan and India to Southeast Asia, the Mediterranean, Latin America, the Arctic, even into cyberspace. Are there some main themes that you saw pop up periodically on this journey?
I think when we look at Chinese investment in Africa and Chinese investment, more broadly, We tend to look at, you know, kind of like, you know, is this predatory? Is there a debt trap? Is this really good for those at the receiving end? And it's a mixed bag. You know, I mean, it's different in each country. There certainly are ways in which the Chinese government and Chinese lenders do look out for their own interests, as many lenders do around the world. But I think it's telling that the African survey group, Afrobarometer, found in 2016, which was pretty much at the height of Chinese lending to Africa, that some more than 60% of Africans surveyed, and they surveyed Africans in several countries, found favorable views of China, that Africans thought favorably of China and of what China was doing in terms of investments in Africa. So I think as we look from outside, it's important to keep in mind that while Chinese investment is imperfect and its record is mixed, that it's not all bad. And in fact, in many places, including Ethiopia, it has transformed many lives for the better.
We've been speaking with Tesfalem Waldyez in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, and Mary Kay Magstad in San Francisco. The entire 9-part podcast that traces Chinese investment around the world is called On China's New Silk Road. It's from the Global Reporting Center. Tess, thank you.
Thank you very much.
And thank you too, Mary Kay.
Thank you, Marco.
In Thailand, a youth-driven protest movement is raging against the conservative establishment. Protesters want to rein in the power of Thailand's royal family. That is a radical idea because Thai royalty is deeply intertwined with religion. As The World's Patrick Nguyen reports from Bangkok, challenging the throne is seen by many in Thailand as heresy.
It's shaving day at the temple, and teenage novice monks are razoring off their eyebrows and head stubble, then rinsing off under a spigot. Out walks the man I've come to meet. He's a monk in his 30s named Graiwit Bunyaseri, dressed in flowing, tangerine-colored robes. The monk leads me inside the prayer hall and sits in a chair by the feet of a giant golden Buddha. And because he is holy and I am not, I speak to him kneeling at his feet on the floor. That's just the way things work. It's been busy around here, he says. Not long ago, there was a visit from royalty, the royal consort, a woman who is a special companion of Thailand's king, not to be confused with his wife, Thailand's queen. Another regular guest of honor here is a princess who happens to be the king's first wife. There have been 4 wives total. The king is 68, and if he and the queen walked in right now, any commoners would have to kneel at their feet as well. Thai royalty are treated as almost sacred. Sacred, not as Westerners see it, the monk says, but every Thai king has a quality called barami. It's like a glorious goodness radiating out to the nation. Faith in the king. That's what binds our hearts and souls together, the monk says. Whatever the king does, it is beyond criticism. This is what every Thai student learns in school. It is almost never challenged. Until now. Protesters shouting, "My taxes, my taxes," a slogan often heard at protests in Bangkok. They're talking about taxes that uphold the palace. It is hard to convey just how shocking this is to hear in Thailand. One protester named Met tells me he never thought this would happen in his lifetime.
We only learn to praise, to pay respect, and to say about the good things, but only good ways about the monarchy. It's illegal to criticize the monarchy in this country.
Very illegal, like more than 10 years in prison illegal. Another protester named Pon says he has no idea if this movement will achieve its goals, like making it legal to question the palace.
It doesn't have to end tomorrow. But anyway, we already set the standard. We already opened the box for the people to come out and say, you can talk about it. That's the whole point. Yeah, for me, I'm happy with that.
Inside this protest movement, there are Reformation vibes. You know, Martin Luther nailing his criticism of the Catholic Church to a wooden door. That Reformation. And just as those ideas were spread with a new invention, the printing press, this movement relies on this era's most revolutionary invention, social media.
They're really active on Twitter and stuff.
Twitter and stuff. Stuff like encrypted messaging apps. That's where some young Thais are asking questions. about the wealth of the palace, about ancient traditions such as kneeling or even crawling at people's feet, and also just gossiping about royal family members. The Reformation in Europe, the one 500 years ago, there was a huge pushback to that, to say the least, and this one is no different. That's a group of royalists showing up to one of these protests and throwing rocks. Now, this is rare. Usually counter-protesters are not violent. Often they tend to be middle-aged, often wearing shirts that are canary yellow, a color linked to the monarchy. But they are holding more rallies now to defend the king from criticism. I went to one of them and asked a woman named Sutira, what do you think of this idea, reforming the monarchy? Reform? Which part, she says? What did they do wrong? They talk about the king's family, she says. But what gives them the right to meddle with that? How many wives he's had? How is that anyone's business? What bad thing, she asks, has the king ever done to this country? Sutira tells me this is a mob of children. All they do is curse and spread lies. You want to protest? Go protest, she says. You want to complain about the prime minister? Fine. But she says, you cannot say anything bad about our king. A lot of Thai people feel this way, that this isn't just a difference of political opinion, it's more like blasphemy. But the government has not figured out how to make the mob of children shut up. Police have locked up dozens of prominent protesters. That hasn't really worked. Also, they keep trying this, blasting protesters with blue or purple liquid that stings the skin. But the students just bring umbrellas. And honestly, this should be the easy part, breaking up street protest. The hard part is stopping the spread of ideas. They'd have to shut down social media, and that would make everyone unhappy, from student radicals to royalist grandmas. And even monks. Monks chanting in a video on the Facebook page of Wat Mulilokayaram. That's the Buddhist temple I visited. It was built about 250 years ago. And yes, the monk Graisit tells me, now we're on social media. Facebook, Twitter, they can be used to spread righteousness, he says, or bad things. The students who want to reform the monarchy, he says. At its core, their movement seems to be fed by their addiction to social media, he says. Well, whatever the cause, it does feel like Thailand has changed. Even 6 months ago, it would be very edgy to interview anyone about the mere idea of monarchy reform. And to bring it up to a monk, a holy figure, almost unthinkable. But here we are. And I'm keen to seize the moment to hear more of the monk's thoughts on this subject. So I press ahead and ask what he thinks.
What do you mean?
And I get nervous laughter. When it comes to the monarchy, he says, look, I'm Thai and therefore under Penal Code Section 112. Yeah, that's a law that says anyone speaking ill of the royal family could be imprisoned for up to 15 years. Not that he has anything bad to share, but with a law that harsh, you tend to watch what you say. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen in Bangkok.
You know, Patrick, and you're used to hearing my voice, but you should really meet some of my amazing colleagues who put a ton of work into the show every day. Come over to theworld.org/whoweare and find out who we are. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for making it today. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.